Okay, this is John McGonigal with the Vietnam Archive at Texas Tech University conducting an oral history interview with Colonel James M. Fitzsimmons. Colonel Fitzsimmons was an F-4 pilot assigned to Da Nang Air Base from 1971 to 1972. Today is November 4th, 2015. I'm in Lubbock, Texas in the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech, and Colonel Fitzsimmons is joining me by phone from Tucson, Arizona. How are you this afternoon, sir?
I think I'm doing fine. We finally got some sunshine.
Good. Well,
it's usually pretty rare. I'm kidding.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, we woke up with a pretty heavy fog today. It just not burned off, though.
Anyway,
while we're on the record, I want to start off first by saying thank you for agreeing to participate. I know this is a chunk of time carved out of your life that I know you're in the middle of doing a little bit of house rebuilding, so I appreciate you doing that. And so let's go ahead and get started. And so I'd like to start off with a little bit of biographical information.
Okay.
First off, when and where you were born, tell me a little bit about what life was like growing up.
Well, I was born in a place called Bath, New York, but we didn't stay there very long. At that time, my father was in the business of building trunks for automobiles, and they started putting trunks into automobiles, and that knocked his business right off the street. And we ended up going to Rochester, New York, where he was born, and we lived there in a duplex. And since he lost his business, he started into real estate, and he stayed in it the rest of his life. Homeowners Loan Corporation was the government thing. He was in that, plus real estate throughout. And we lived in a place called on Lake Avenue in Rochester, New York, in a duplex, as I mentioned. And my mother was a teacher by profession. And my brother and sister, both older than I was the baby of the family. And we lived, like I said, on Lake Avenue in Rochester, New York, about four blocks from Eastman Kodak, which was probably the biggest operation going on in the city of Rochester in those days. But as you know, Eastman Kodak's kind of gone downhill.
Mm-hmm.
And in growing up, I went to Catholic grammar school, only a block and a half away or so, right across from Sacred Heart Cathedral. And my brother and sisters, both preceded me there. Like I said, I the baby. And after grammar school, I went to parochial high school called St. Thomas Aquinas, all boys school. And that's about it. Then on to college, but I actually worked a year on the New York State Railroad to earn enough money to get to college. Backing the grammar school was a very nice school, boys and girls. In the high school, like I said, was all boys.
What was the name of the grammar school?
Sacred Heart. Just like the church.
Okay.
Sacred Heart. And very good school, nice kids, boys and girls. I also, while I was there, I had a paper route that I picked up in my eighth grade, I guess. And I thought it was the best paper route in the city of Rochester. And I say that because my route was over 100 papers, but it was all covering just one block. And the reason for that was Eastman Kodak, when old George started his business, people would like to live around where all the factories were. And so you had duplexes and triplexes mostly around the whole block. And that way I could be delivering two or three papers to the same home style. And like I said, I had over 100 papers, customers. And they treated me well at Christmas.
Well, having 100 papers in your paper route, it's really nice to have a high density urban environment.
Oh yeah, it was that.
So you graduated grammar school, went to St. Thomas. What year was that? Did you transition from grammar school to St. Thomas Aquinas?
Well, let me see. I'll work backwards. I graduated from college in 55. I graduated from Aquinas in 50. So I was 18 when I graduated from Aquinas. Like I said, from there I didn't have money to go to college. My brother was already in college at the University of Rochester. And after making my money on the railroad, I followed my brother into University of Rochester.
Okay, so let me back up just for a second. So, father's name and mother's name.
Father's name was Philip.
Philip.
And mother's name was Anne.
Okay.
My brother and sister.
Okay.
My brother was Philip also.
Okay.
And my sister, Mary Ellen. And Mary Ellen didn't go to college. She went right into working, I guess, when she finished high school. And so Phil and I were the two that made it through. As a matter of fact, as an aside, when I went to college to University of Rochester, like I said, of course I was busting my back to get money to get in there. So I mentioned a couple of people that I first met there. I said, hey, you know, the draft's kind of after all of us, especially at our ages, and I don't want to get hung up in that business since I just busted my butt to get here. And one of them said to me, why don't you join ROTC? And I said, what the hell's ROTC? And he told me, and so that will keep you out of the draft, obviously. So I took Air Force ROTC, didn't even know what it stood for. But I felt comfortable that I'm going to be able to stay in college. And it was after my sophomore year in the Air Force ROTC that the commander of the unit had an old Goonie bird. He had to get his flying time. And so he decided he'd get his flying time by taking a bunch of us for a ride. And so we went from Rochester, New York, where it was colder than you know what, and flew down to Fort Walton Beach, Florida. And it was the first time I was ever in an airplane. They let us go up in the cockpit and watch them do things. And then we went swimming in the middle of December in Fort Walton Beach. And I thought, whoa, now this I can handle.
Wow.
And that's how I ended up in the Air Force.
Well, that's probably better than any scholarship or any other type of motivation they can give you. Give you a ride from New York in the middle of winter down to Florida.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, let's back up to that railroad job just for a moment. That's a new one. What was that like? What kind of job was that?
Well, backing up a little bit, I went in Eastman Kodak first, since it was right in my neighborhood. And I was a runner of around the different buildings, you know, with paperwork and mm-hmm. so on. And I think I lasted about a month. And the reason I quit was everybody at Eastman Kodak ate, slept, drank, and defecated Eastman Kodak. And I just thought, I'm too young to die in that business. So that's when I quit and went on the railroad. And the railroad was interesting from one standpoint, because you didn't stay right in Rochester. You worked out of different places in the state of New York, because New York State Railroad, one of them goes, the main road will go from New York City north to Albany and then straight across to Buffalo, New York. But they also had another one that went around southern New York. So you would be ending up going to, I would say, 6 or 7 different places to work, putting up mostly telecommunications, you know, where you climb poles. I didn't, but you worked on the ground for putting in switches and things like that for the tracks. So I'd be in Buffalo, I'd be in southern Elmira, and you live in boarding cars, and you slept in them, and you ate in them, and usually came home for weekends, but most of the time you were away from home. And that was different than maybe a predecessor to how things in the Air Force went too.
Huh. Wow, that's interesting. Do they still do that today? I mean, what people that work for the railroad, do they stay in these boarding cars? And
That's a good question. I know they did for many years, but I only know one young fella out here in Tucson. Our neighbor's son went into it, and but he wasn't working on the groundwork. He was actually into the driving of trains. So my guess is that they may come out of home during the week, and I don't know if they are far away from home or not. I think most of them are on short-term runs, kind of like the airlines.
Well, you graduated high school in 1950. There's a lot of interesting things happened in 1950. You know, from the 50s and 60s, socially speaking and even technically speaking, the United States was really at the forefront of a lot of things. You know, we started to get into that hydrogen bomb era, and where the Soviet Union would detonate a bomb and, you know, show how powerful they could make one. And then I think Truman, I think, was the president then, and we would let one go and show how big it was. And was that kind of thing discussed around the family dinner table on the weekends, what was happening?
It was to some degree, but I think we were more concerned with what's going on locally as far as living in Rochester. And I commuted. I didn't stay on campus. So it was more of a home life. Of course, one of the things that happened, we lost our father when I was about 14, just starting into high school. So most of our attention was at home, and he was my paperwork. And like I mentioned, Brother Phil majored in engineering. And then he did get drafted for the Korean War.
Oh, okay.
And,
so suddenly that became a little more important around
the
talk about.
Oh, yes. He did well in engineering. And when he came back from Korea, he had a job in engineering on a factory down on Lake Ontario. And after about a year and a half or two, he comes home and says, I think I'll go and be a lawyer. So he went to D.C. and worked and night school and whatever, and came out a patent attorney, and did very well at it. And Mary Ellen was working in the city and local jobs there. Mine was to concentrate on college, and I always worked going through college too. So I guess I didn't get that much involved in what's going on, you know, outside of the city of Rochester.
I did find one thing that was interesting. I just happened to stumble on it. It was the Brighton gas explosion of 1951. Did you remember about that happened in Rochester?
Yeah, vaguely, I'll be honest with you. Brighton is kind of a suburb of Rochester. And I don't recall what ignited the explosion. You know, usually expect something like that from big companies like Eastman Kodak or whatever. But no, I'm not too well tuned in on that. Brighton, New York, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was something about the gas flow issue from the plant, I guess, overpressurized and sent a bunch of high pressure gas into these homes, I guess.
Yeah, it sounds familiar now. But it didn't strike me that much, I guess.
Well, that was the big news I could find in Rochester. But the let me back up just a little bit with Brother Philip. So a Korean War veteran, what did he do during the Korean War? Do you know?
Well, he was in the engineering field, so he was mostly keyed in the area of around the capital, or even down where I once was at the Osan, Korea. And, of course, they were moving around in those days, as you well know,
mm-hmm.
back and forth, and a big push going back.
Do you know what years he was there?
Let me see. It was probably 50... I was there from 50 to 54. I mean, 51 to 55. So put him in there about 52.
Okay.
Would be, sounds right, close to it.
So 52, we were almost back across the 38th parallel.
Yeah.
I think. I remember.
Yeah.
Of course, before that, we were all the way down to Busan.
He was primarily in Seoul, I think, or suburbs thereof.
Okay. Well, he was an engineer, so you know, I know the engineers moved around, probably doing a lot of bridge repair and things like that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, pretty interesting. All right, so we left high school and we went off to college, and
yeah. My brother was in the fraternity there called the Deacs. So when I got there, I obviously kind of investigated what they were like because Brother Phil was there, and I ended up joining the Deacs.
Huh.
And they used to call them the Drunken Deacs. Neither one of us lived on campus, but that's where the Deac house was. And fraternities were big in those days. And I ended up being the manager of the Deac house after my junior year, I guess. So I had some management going on in that thing.
and the college was still in the hometown, right?
Oh yeah, Rochester.
Okay. Yep. And so were you living at the house then, or were you still commuting back and forth?
No, I commuted all the way, even up to my full senior year.
Okay,
no, I did not live in the Deac house, but that's what a bunch of the Deacs did, especially guys from out of town, obviously.
Right. And so did you have any sports activity in high school or college that you kept up with?
No. I guess the main reason was I was usually working. Sometimes a summer job would call me back, even though I'd, you know, got a pretty good full college work going on. I know one year, I think it was my sophomore year, I had been working with an outfit called Wilmerite, Jim Wilmont. And he built homes, and he was big, I mean, as far as home building is concerned. And I worked there during the summer, and putting in septic systems for all these houses. And I think it was during the sophomore year, they called me up after I had finished for the summer, and they said, hey, can you work part-time for, it was a night watchman type thing, and I said, yeah, I guess I can try that. So I was, it was a good place to do homework, too, so I was earning money there. So between that and the homework and the studies, I didn't have much time to do anything else.
So as you started making your way through college and your this Air Force ROTC thing was going on, and I imagine it had the same type of program. You go for 2 years, and then there's some sort of commitment you have to make, and then you go for your last 2 years, or was it a little different back then?
No, that's exactly what it was. You didn't, well, if you were, if you had a scholarship with the Air Force ROTC, you were a contract student. If you were that bright and got into that business in your freshman or sophomore year, well then, you already signed up, obviously. If you're just going in and taking it as a subject and were not in scholarship, you really didn't get into the pay zone until the beginning of the junior year. And that's where you signed up. And then you had a stipend of some type, but it wasn't like a full-time Air Force ROTC scholarship. But like I said, once they put me in an airplane, I got completely interested, seriously interested in the Air Force ROTC.
So I'm trying to remember when President Eisenhower was elected, that I think he was likely president in 1955 when you graduated.
Mm-hmm.
So there's still a lot of things going on, even though it's not quite as bad as the 60s yet. I think we're probably already... even though Korea's winding down and becoming...
Well, that's, to answer your question, or at least associate, things were winding down, and we did not go in immediately upon graduation. I was not called in until January or February after graduation.
Oh.
So
you graduated in May and went through that whole year? Up till January and February?
I graduated in May and then came on active duty in February. So yeah, it was... I continued working with Wilmot Company, so... But when I got the call, and by this time, my honey and I had... signed on for life, got married, and
okay. And your wife's name, for the record, is Joan. What was her maiden name?
Deisenroth, Deisenroth.
And was she a Rochester lady, or
yes, she went to parochial high school. Mercy High School, just like I went to a parochial Catholic High School, Aquinas. So, we met during the, let me see, it was in high school, I think I was a senior at that time, and we met, and through a friend of mine, and quick short story, we dated, and like I said, I lived in the city near Eastman Kodak on Lake Avenue, which is almost, Lake Avenue ends at Lake Ontario, but it goes all the way up into mid-city, and we had a Riviera Theater right across from our home, because we're on kind of a main drag. And the name of the theater was the Riviera, and I used to say, I lived in a 19th century villa overlooking the Riviera. Because we lived in a duplex and people rented the upstairs part of our house and so on and so on. In any event, so Joan, my wife, my girlfriend back then, we'd been dating for almost 6 months or so, and she thought time for me to meet her mom and dad. And they lived in a suburb of Rochester called Penfield, and her father was a milkman and had been for years, and he would come from Penfield into the dairy and get his truck and so on. In any event, we go we go into her house and meet her mom. Hello, how are you? Yes, I'm Jim Fitzsimmons, and enjoyed dating your daughter here, sweet lady. And then her father, Eustace, E-U-S-T-A-C-E, called him Eustace. He said, Jim Fitzsimmons, And where do you live? I told him we're in Lake Avenue there, right across from the Riviera Theater. And he says to me, do you have a dog named Cinder? And I thought, how the hell could he? I've never met the man. And he calls me out. I said, yes, as a matter of fact, I do. And lo and behold, he was our milkman.
I'll be darned.
Known that. And he knew the dog Cinder. He knew my mother, because on occasions, on Saturdays, I guess, he'd stop and have coffee with her, because I lost my father when I was, I think I mentioned that.
That's right.
I was about 14. So mother went back into the teaching business. And so, yeah, they'd have coffee once in a while. And yes, we had a dog named Cinder, but it blew my mind that, you know, small world.
That's pretty funny that he calls up your dog's name just to,
yeah,
just to see how fast you were on your feet, I guess.
Yeah, just to prove he knew me better than I did.
I want to ask you a quick question about your mother, Anne. Did what kind of teacher was she?
It was just standard teaching for grade school. She wasn't
okay.
Teaching high school or anything. It was strictly kindergarten and whatever other grades, early grades, I think.
What school did she teach at?
Oh, God. I forget the name of it. It was on the other side of town. I know that. Like I said, we lived on the north side, almost to Lake Ontario.
Huh.
And she'd be teaching on the east side. And sometimes it was kind of hard districts that she taught into. By that I mean by composition of the people in that area.
Right. So she wasn't in any mood to put up with you and your brother and your sister when she got home?
No, she was a doer. My father was in the real estate business, but he's also a diabetic. And he had to take insulin and all that good stuff. And another war story. I walked back and forth to Sacred Heart every day, grammar school. And I would come home, and on one or two occasions, my father would be on the floor, maybe in the living room or the dining room, and I'd have to call an ambulance. And the problem was, he'd get up and take his insulin in the morning before eating. That was standard in those days.
Mm-hmm.
And occasionally he'd go back and do a little more sleeping, and that was a no-no, because when you take insulin, you immediately have to eat, get sugar in your system, and he may sleep a little too late and wake up, or almost wake up, and figure out he's got to get, you know, something in his body. But on a couple occasions, he never made it to the kitchen, and it was hard to take, you know, young fellow and see dead on the floor and wondering what in God's name. And with an insulin reaction, because he was a diabetic, like I mentioned. And I don't know if that had any bearing on the short life. Of course, he was a World War I veteran, you know, to the real war back then.
I didn't know that. Yeah, that's, was he in the Army?
Yeah. World War I.
Do you remember what unit he was in?
I think it was just an infantry. I know he got subject to gas, you know, that they use as a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't know if he didn't get his gas mask on or got it and then put it on or what, but so he was, he had taken a hit or two. And that probably contributed to his shorter life, too.
Hmm. And, let's see, you said you were about 14 when he passed away, and your brother is how much older than you?
My brother is 3 years older than I.
So he was 19. So your brother hadn't gone into the Army at 19, right?
Oh, no.
He went through college. No. Okay.
No. Because he didn't go until about a year after college, or 6 months after college.
So when your dad, do you remember much about that when he came home?
You're coming in very weak.
Oh. Hold on,
John, can you hear me?
I can. Sorry about that. I think my microphone started to tilt away from me. How's that?
Yeah, I think you're going to have to tune that up a little bit.
I had the same problem on the last one. Is that better?
Yeah, but not much. But I can hear you.
Huh. Okay. Well, if I start fading off, say something, so I'll continue to ramp up my volume here so we can get it all recorded properly. I was going to ask you, Colonel Fitzsimmons, when your dad came back, do you remember when he came back from World War I?
No, I do not.
Okay. Did he ever have any stories about, you know, going over to France or anything like that?
No, he never talked much about the war. And I think in those days, as treacherous as the whole thing was, you didn't hear many of them speaking of it.
Right.
But no, he did not speak of any notoriety.
Okay. Well, that's really interesting. So it's military service has been in the family for quite some time.
Oh, yeah.
And you don't remember any of the locations that he served at when he was over there in France, do you?
No, I do not.
Okay. Well, that's...
But he was there. My uncle was there. One of my uncles. He came from a family of five brothers and I think it was three sisters. Big family.
Huh.
Farm business way back when.
Did your father and his brother serve together in the same unit, or were they in different locations?
No, different locations, different units.
Okay. All right. Huh. That's very interesting. Okay, so let's go back up to... I apologize dragging you all around the history books here, but let's go to back over to college. So you're getting ready to graduate. It's about 1955. You get commissioned, and you've got this delay, and so you kind of go back into the house building business.
Yes.
Putting in septic tanks, and now pretty soon you're getting ready to go on active duty. What was Mom thinking about all this? Was she happy with this, or was she upset you were doing this?
No, not at all. We lost, I'm trying to think, passed away. She didn't have diabetes, but she had something else that was shortening her life. As a matter of fact, she lived with my sister until she passed away. And I forget the year.
Well, she was still around when you graduated college?
Yes.
Okay.
She was.
So she knew you were commissioned and you were getting ready to go on active duty.
Yep.
Okay.
And she was at our wedding and everything else.
Oh, good. So she was pretty happy about this. She looked
oh,
like,
yes.
Okay. Good.
Oh, yeah. And she even visited us when, she visited us when we were going to pilot training. And several years after that, she was still visiting us. But in the meantime, it picked up whatever that bug was that was shortening her life and moved in with my sister. So up until that time, as long as she was on her feet and going places and doing things, she came and visited us in Florida and visited us in Oklahoma.
All right. And when she lived with your sister, was that in Rochester?
Yes, Mary Ellen was still there, and she had married. She married a Navy officer.
Oh.
And they bought a home in Rochester, and had two youngsters. And I forget what he did. He was in transportation of some type with companies in Rochester. As a matter of fact, my sister and her husband are still alive in the city of Rochester, and they live in one of these nursing homes. And they sold their home and moved in, and they're getting along very nicely.
Wow. All right.
So that's a blessing. We see them every summer when we head back to New York.
And do they stay up there all year long?
Yes.
Okay.
I lost Brother Phil last year, the patent attorney.
Yep.
And what happened to him about 10 or 12 years ago, he had his own business. He worked for another patent attorney when he first got his license and everything.
Yeah.
And when that guy sold the business, Brother Phil took it over and did very well in it as a patent attorney. And about, like I said, 10, 12 years ago, he had a heart attack. And he was doing some work in his office and talking into a microphone, you know, where he's going to have it taped or whatever for his secretary so she can type it up and so on. And the secretary said that he was talking away in his mic and so on, and all of a sudden stopped talking. And she went, oh, well, she went in there. His head was right down on his desk, and he had a heart attack.
Oh, shoot.
And bad enough so that they had the ambulance in there and over to the hospital and got him there in time. And they had to even operate on his head because of the blood and so on. And so that was a stroke. And since that time, he eventually had to give up the business. He sold it and had to stay at home. And he and his bride from the days of yesteryear made a deal, and the deal was, hey, if anything ever happens to either one of us, we're not going to submit them to a nursing home or anything. And so his wife has been taking care of him for the last 8 years because he stayed at home and originally was kind of mobile, but in the end he was in a wheelchair.
Oh, man. God bless her.
He passed away last February.
And she's still around. Phil's wife is still alive.
Phil's wife is still around and doing very well. Lonesome, obviously, but...
Is she up in the Rochester area?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
They've lived in Rochester the whole time.
All right, so we graduate college, and we we do a little bit of work on the side, and then we eventually get called up to active duty, and what's the first thing that happens?
Well, you had to go down to San Antonio for headquarters and indoctrination or whatever, and then off to pilot training at Oklahoma, Enid, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Vance Air Force Base. And did pilot training there. And I'm sorry, I take that back. I jumped too much. We came out here, called up in February, colder than hell in Rochester. Went down to indoctrination in San Antonio and then off to pilot training. And pilot training was at Enid, Oklahoma. I'm sorry. Memories. Talking right here in Tucson. Marana is the base just north of
Tucson. Oh, that's right. I forgot about Marana.
You know all of that.
Yeah.
And so that was primary. And coming from Rochester, New York in February and coming to Tucson, Arizona in the middle of winter, I said, holy geez, this is just like starting out flying airplanes. Pretty nice area. And of course, that's how we got in Tucson for the rest of our lives, on and off. Anyway, primary pilot there. Then off to Greenville, Mississippi for basic training. Then instructor training after that. And then Enid, Oklahoma for instructing in the T-33.
Okay. And so let's go back to Marana here for a minute. What aircraft was out there for primary?
T-34 and T-28, both
okay.
Props. My instructor was a farmer, owned a farm. He didn't have to be in the military in those days to instruct.
So he was like a Department of the Air Force civilian, or was he just a civilian?
Yeah, something to that effect. Whoever was running pilot training there, I don't know if it was a commercial outfit, it must have been because he was a civilian. Or he was a civilian in the government.
So which aircraft was the first one, the T-34 or the T-28?
The T-34.
Okay. And that was, let me think, the T-34 was probably a little bit newer, wasn't it? Or was the T-28 the newer one?
No, the 34, I think, was the newer one. 28 was an older bird. It was a big bird. And
big difference between those two engines. One's
oh, yeah.
Got a big radial engine. The other one's got a little Continental in it, I think.
That's right.
So, but they put you in the T-34 first, so you did your, probably did some...
You're in there for a couple months, and then into the 28. And the Navy 28 was a three-bladed, and the Air Force was two. I remember that being one of the differences.
Was it a joint school? Did you have Navy guys there with you?
No.
Okay.
No, it was strictly Air Force. In Greenville, Mississippi was also all Air Force.
And Greenville was probably, what was down in Greenville?
Pardon me?
What was down in Greenville? What aircraft were you flying?
T-Bird.
The T-33, okay. And then you went from, okay, and then T-33, that's your first introduction to a jet engine.
That is correct.
Okay, I bet that, what was that like?
Hey, it was a blessing, it was very interesting. You moved a little faster and you had to move a little faster. And of course you went from just getting checked out in the airplane into formation and things of that nature and instruments. And then when I went to pilot training school, or I mean instructor training, it was more of the same. And when we got to Enid, Oklahoma, the big change there was they were transitioning from multi-engine prop to jets. So you would get some of these guys that have been doing nothing but flying props, and now we're checking them out in T-33s.
Was there any Any bad habit transfers there between those?
There was only one where I had to grab the stick when I was teaching him the formation. And he was just coming in too fast, and I shoved the stick down and out and went underneath the guy who was trying to join up on. That memory sticks pretty well.
So you started off in Marana. Is there at some point in this training that you actually get your Air Force wings, or do you have to go all the way through Vance before you're awarded your wings?
No, you're awarded the wings after Greenville, Mississippi.
Okay.
So it's 6 months in Prop and then 6 months in T-Bird.
Okay. And then from Greenville, we went up to Vance.
Yeah, the only interesting part about Vance was... I may have told you the story, but instrument training. You teach them instruments, you teach them formation, the whole bit. And I got a kid up there one day, and he's under the hood. And we'd taken off out of the Vance, and we're just heading down toward Oak City. And he's under the hood doing all everything he's supposed to be doing. And I'm just watching the sun and everything, and all of a sudden, all hell goes pop, bang, bow. And the airplane feels like it's falling apart. In any event, I started to shut the engine down. I said, hey, this could be bad. Get ready to punch out if I tell you to. And his comment to me was, can I come out from under the hood? And I said, wait a minute, yeah, never mind. The hood goes with the canopy, remember? Oh, yeah. And so I shut the engine down, became very quiet, and looked around and see what I had. And we're up around 20,000 or 20, around that 20,000.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask you. What altitude you were at when it started?
Yeah, because, you know, we'd already climbed out, level off and all that stuff. So I went to guard and alerted Oak City because my choice was going to be to go into Oak City. I couldn't get back to Vance. And we ended up dumping the ticks. I had to get rid of those because you don't want to go crashing in or trying to get on the ground with those things. And you get lighter and you get better mileage.
Were those full at the time?
Yeah, it's pretty much so. Instrument flights, you usually had full tips because mm-hmm. you're up there for a long time. In any event, I opted to dump them in the, I think this is the South Coast River, I forget the name of it. Which is south of Oak City. And so then we head back to the municipal airport.
North Canadian River.
North Canadian River, thank you.
That's right. I was having the moment there, but I knew I had it in my mind.
Thank you. I appreciate that. In any event, we dumped the tanks, we came in, and the old adage here, what you did, you do a 360 overhead, you know, descending down to the runway, and drop the gear at high gear point, right directly over the field, and then do a 360 and come in. So I drop the gear, coming around about 270 degree point, and all of a sudden I hear a voice saying, you don't have any gear, you don't have any gear, it's coming from the tower. I said, oh shit. And so I said to my backseater, hey, if you can get that down, of course it's
it's like a T-handle that you got to blow a hydraulic bottle or something.
Yeah, and it's once he pulls it, it's a separate operation to get it down, a one-stroke type thing. So in any event, he hit the emergency handle, is what I was looking for. And all of a sudden the gear shows itself as one down, where it was three before. That's why I hadn't even thought of it. And when I lowered the handle the first time. And in any event, he gets it down. The left main goes down, and at the base leg almost, the second comes down, and we're just about on final, and almost at the flare, and the third one comes down. And I even had enough speed after I touched down to turn off the runway. And as I turned off and stopped, they had a bunch of Marines there on guard, foot of his guard was flying those days. And I got the canopy open, and this guy yells up to me, he says, "Man, you ought to see the hole." I said, "Well, there's full three holes back there. That's part of the engine." He said, "No, I mean in the side. And there's a hole in the side about the size of your head." And what had happened was the blades on the engine, you know, back in the tail end, about five of them had gone broken right off the hulk of the engine and went right through the side of the airplane. And that's how we ended up with that stupid thing anyways.
I'll be darned.
So that was interesting for Enid, Oklahoma.
And so did they ever find your tip tanks in the North Canadian River?
You know, I have never found it out. I have never found it out. And I guess I didn't want to. The guys back in Eden were just glad to see us back. So we got the little stuff.
There's probably a wheat farmer up there somewhere that's using it as a birdhouse or something.
When I got home, I was saying, "Oh, boy." Got home to hug my wife and had a cold beer. And about that time, they called me up from the base and say, "You need to come back out." I said, "For what?" He said, "We do a post-physical for, you know, when you have a problem like that." And so I went back out and I said, "Well, I'll leave the beer at home. Is that okay?" He said, "Yeah, we don't care what you're doing. Come on." So we can do a double take.
So how long did you fly T-33s up there?
Well, let me see. I think it was a couple of years. Because then I went down to, they needed help down at Randolph. I think I'm getting this right. And Randolph had the senior, I forget what the program is called, but you're checking out higher-ranking people who have never flown jets at Randolph. These guys are coming from the Pentagon. They're coming from, you know, you're teaching everything from full colonels to majors, occasionally a one-star, and you're checking them out in the T-Bird. And they're, instead of a six-month course or whatever, it's only about 2 months or so. And you're just getting them checked out, some instrument, some formation, and then they go back to the Pentagon or whatever. And it was enlightening for me. I think I got more out of it than they did. Because, you know, you're sitting, you're ready to come in flying for the day, starting in the morning, whatever. And you'd have two or three students, majors, lieutenant colonels, colonels, whatever. And you walk in the morning, and they all come to attention at the table. And it's embarrassing. That was the rule, you know, that the instructor was God. And you had to treat them like that, I guess, from a military standpoint. And like I said, that was interesting. I think we had it for a couple of years. I failed to mention back in out here in Arizona for checking out the first 6 months. Our first was born. He was born at Davis Mountain. And you're familiar with that?
I am.
And the second one came through in Oklahoma. The third one at San Antonio. No, was it San Antonio? Yeah, I guess. And in any event, that was a real education for me, teaching senior officers how to fly airplanes.
I bet. Yeah, it's more than just the mechanics. You have to do a little bit of, I don't want to call it politics, but there's a lot of delicate conversations you have to have.
Oh, yes. No doubt about it. As a matter of fact, one fellow was, he kind of had me stand against the side of the aircraft, my student, mind you. And it was a different formality because usually, you know, it's yes sirs, no sirs, or whatever. And this colonel says to me, Fitz, you know what you're going to be doing? And I said, not in the long run, sir, but he says, you're going to be a colonel someday. I said, oh, well, thank you. Nice to hear from senior ranking officers. All I'm doing is teaching them how to fly jets.
So you're at Randolph for a little bit, and it's mostly T-33s, I think?
Yes, and 38s came in at that time.
Okay.
And they were, that was going to be our next airplane to fly. And we'd see some of these guys, of other T-Bird pilots there, who were getting 38. Matter of fact, I think it was indoctrination of 38 was at Randolph before it went into basic training pilot bases with airplanes.
So
we shortly thereafter checked out in the 38, yeah.
So you got to fly the 38 at Randolph?
Pardon me?
Did you get to fly the T-38 at Randolph?
Yes.
Okay. Are you still having trouble hearing me?
Just right there for a minute, yes.
Okay.
It could be my pressing this thing against my ear, too.
Okay, so you got checked out into T-38. That's a supersonic aircraft. What did you get a chance to open that up a little bit when you first got checked out?
It was a beautiful airplane. I mean, God, yes, thoroughly enjoyed it. The only problem I can remember once down there, I don't know if it was there or later on when I was at Webb. In any event, I think it was down there. 38, loved the airplane, whatever. And I think it was when I had one of the majors or colonels or whatever. It took off, and right about the time I was yanking up the gear, thing kind of slowed down. I thought, what's that? In any event, I had a problem with one engine. And it didn't flame out, but it just flared back on me on takeoff. So I had to bring that dude around and get it back on the ground.
Hmm. How's the T-38 fly with one engine?
Well, it can, but when you're full, you know, for takeoff, it's a little concerning. You just go out and bring it in a little faster, but get it back on the ground.
Do you have the option to dump fuel out of that during that situation?
I think we did, yes.
Okay.
I think we did. I wouldn't swear to it. But that was a beautiful airplane, I mean.
I see a note here that when you were in San Antonio, you also worked on your master's degree. Was that during the Randolph assignment?
Yes.
Okay.
That's correct. And I was doing that when I had the spare time, obviously.
Hmm.
And
it looks like that was
then
it.
I got picked up for a remote to Korea.
Okay.
And went to Osan.
And what aircraft were you flying there?
T-Birds.
The T-Birds still? Okay.
Yep. And that was remote, and so Joan and the boys stayed in San Antonio, and I ended up in command center work, which was, you know, swing shift, morning, noon, night, and whatever.
Was that at the HTAC?
HTAC fighter.
So that's on Osan Air Base, on the HTAC, and but you still got to fly. So it was a flying assignment, but you had some command and control.
No, the you just flew to stay current.
Okay.
Because your main job was with the command center.
Was it? It was still 7th Air Force then, right?
I do believe.
Okay.
And you lived in the hoots with the rest of the troops, and one lovely thing that came out of that was I've been a smoker all through shortly after high school or whatever. And I'd be on midnight shift in the command center. And what do? You smoke and coffee and stuff like that. Come out in the morning and people are saying, "I fit," and I'd say, "Oh, that's what it did to my voice." So I said, "That's it, I'm going to give up smoking." Well, you live in a hooch with seven other guys, you know, and they're all smokers. I said, "I'm giving up smoking." Well, you can admit, "Oh, yeah, that's sure, And got on my case. Well, I stuck to it, and never had another cigarette since.
Wow, good for you. I didn't know that. Seems like probably more people started smoking in Korea than actually quit, I imagine.
Well, with me, I had to go top notch because, you know, I'm telling these guys I'm going to quit smoking. They say, "Oh, yeah, let's quit smoking." They just razz the hell out of me for the duration. But it worked fine.
Well, I bet that was a nice surprise for your family when you
got
Joni back.
For Joni Baby, yeah, yeah, because she didn't smoke.
I bet she appreciated that.
So
all right. So what happened after? Did you already have a follow-on assignment at from OSON, or did you have to work that out when you with your assignment handler at OSON?
Coming out of OSON, I had tentative orders to go to Japan, and I forget what it was, another headquarters or something. And I thought, hey, that's not too bad. So I alerted my wife and kids. I said, "Hey, it sounds like we were going to go ahead to Japan." I forget the name of the base. Well, about a month after that, that was canceled because of the closure or whatever. I don't know what went under PACAF headquarters. So the quick switch was you're going to Texas. Trying to think of the name of the base. Big Spring, Texas.
Oh, okay. And, is that Webb? Is that
Webb?
Okay.
That's what I wanted. And geez, that sounded fine to me as far as going to go back to 38th and fly and so on, good stuff. And Joni heard she was going not to Japan but to Big Spring, Texas. It didn't go over too well. But to make a long story short, it was a very good assignment. I'm back in 38. I was selected for academics, and so I did both. And the one thing that had happened when I first got there, I'd been there about 6 months, and like I said, in academics teaching. And we had a new commander come in. And somehow I ran into him at the club or someplace and got to know him pretty well. And he had heard I just come back from Korea. And what I had done in San Antonio in that first tour down there, like I mentioned, I was working on my master's. And the new commander, it said something about, "Well, Fitz, you got to finish that degree." I said, "Well, I sure hope to." And then that all went aside. And then I had tentative orders for Vietnam. And
so what?
He said to me, when he heard I was getting orders for Vietnam, he said, "Fitz, didn't you finish that degree yet?" I said, "No, sir, I'm afraid not. It's, we just haven't gotten to it." He said, "Well, you're going to get to it right now." And all of a sudden, he cuts me in for completing my degree in San Antonio. And so Joan and I and the family moved to San Antonio, and I managed to finish my master's there.
I'll be darned. So he was looking out for you.
He certainly was. Well, I told him in the beginning I thought he was a great guy. And in any event.
Now, so this, so you were moved, so this was like some sort of an AFIT program or something where they just moved you to complete your degree?
Yes, it was under Ethan. Huh. Yeah.
And what year was that? Do you remember? That's probably 67?
Korea in... Well, I forget the year, just like other forgets here.
Yeah.
But I'll think of it in a moment.
Well, you went to F4RTU in 68, so it's probably just before that, right?
Yeah, because I never got to Vietnam until 71 and 2.
Right.
Because when I finished my master's, I went back in 38, but I went to Fort Walton Beach. No. Homestead Air Force Base.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't direct after I finished the F-4 training, I mean, is what I'm saying.
Okay.
So, came out here after we got the master's finished, went back to Webb for a little while, 38, and then got orders to come to Davis-Monthan for F-4 training. And so we came back out here and went through F-4 training. And then, instead of going directly to Vietnam, I ended up at Homestead in F-4s. And that was a two-year assignment, 18 months, 2 years, something like that. And then off to Vietnam.
So Homestead, is it the same version of the F-4s, the F-4E?
It was E down there, yeah.
Okay.
And we lived on base. And that got me to my second tour in Korea. And I thought, what the hell am I going back to Korea for? It's Vietnam I'm, you know, getting taught for and want to go there. And what happened, Pueblo incident, you remember that?
Right, yeah, I do remember that.
As a result of the Pueblo incident, all of a sudden we went out of Homestead, nonstop to Korea. And, well, nonstop. We went to from Homestead to Hawaii. From Hawaii to Guam. And from Guam into Kunsan, Korea. So here I am back in Korea instead of Vietnam. Well, that's why we went over there, because of the Pueblo, the show of force.
I'll be darned.
And that was a 6 month type thing. Then when I came back from there, then I headed to Vietnam from Homestead.
So the did you do any flying at Kunsan? I mean, were we setting anything up to harass or let the Koreans know that we want our boat back?
It was strictly a show of force, and all the exercises out of Kunsan were to the gunnery range and so on, because they had not, we never did go north on that thing, but we were a show of force, which evidently at least showed the North Koreans they better get their act together, and which they did, and we ended up peacefully getting out of there.
Huh. And you spent 6 months over there doing that?
Yes, yeah.
Did you ever have any, did they ever come up with any of their fighters, any of their MiG fighters come
no,
up to challenge
no,
you?
No, did not. Because we, most of our stuff was right near the DMZ, just on this side of it. So, that was fortunate.
Hmm. Wow. I didn't realize that you had that deployment. So you came back from that deployment back to Homestead?
Yes. And Homestead was strictly, F-4 training more, or going to the gunnery ranges and so on. We'd also have alert at Homestead, however. And the reason we had alert was because of Cuba. And Cuba never did anything. But occasionally, they would, the Cuban air people would say sayonara and come over and hands up, give up their airplane, and they land at Homestead.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Several of those guys come up.
So, did you have any of those where you escorted them in?
The only thing we did, as soon as, you know, if you're sitting alert, for example, if they have an unknown coming from the south, we'd get launched. Well, some of those are just prop-type things that had been low on the water and then climbed up or whatever and show on the radar. Or they'd be one of the jets seriously coming out of Cuba. And they would land at Homestead. So that was about the most interesting flying as far as sitting alert and so on.
I bet, you know, see, you know, get a MiG-21 or something like that landing at Homestead
yeah.
is probably pretty interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
So what happened then? Once you so we're in Homestead and you get to the end of your assignment, and then so are you getting a PCS orders for Vietnam, or are they, or is this?
I'm sorry, John, you're coming in weak again.
Oh, nuts.
There.
Is that better?
There.
Okay. Well, shoot. I must have a loose wire on this thing. I'll just keep telling me when it's going down, and I'll keep adjusting it. I'm trying not to move.
Okay. You're coming in now. Okay.
So when you get to, you're back at Homestead. Is the unit at Homestead deploying to Vietnam, or are you just getting PCS orders for
no,
a unit?
No, I want PCS.
Okay. And what unit is that that you're getting these orders for?
Gunfighters at Da Nang.
Okay. And that was that the 366?
I was there from 70-71. Time frame.
Okay. Was there one tour or two tours that you had there?
No, it was one tour.
Okay.
It was for a year. Matter of fact, when I got there at Da Nang, I was a major. And all the young flight commanders, you know, first lieutenants, captains, so on. And I didn't want to bounce one of them. In other words, I was a senior ranking guy coming into the unit with the lieutenants going back to space time. And I said, geez, I don't want to bump guys who have such a good, you know, they're proud of their jobs and their ranking at the time. And it was either go to headquarters or, in any event, an old friend of mine had maintenance. And he said, why don't you take my job, Fitz? I said, I can't even spell maintenance. He said, no, that's been work. In any event, I took it. Two young captains, maintenance guys, plus all the young airmen. And I can honestly say it's the best job I ever had in the Air Force. Did all my own test ops. The young airmen, super good. Matter of fact, I started Airman of the Month over there.
I'll tell you what, but before we get into that, if you don't mind, let me back up. So what, when you got your orders from Homestead, how did you get from Homestead to Vietnam?
It was a regular PCS job where you went over in the heavies. I didn't fly over there, no.
So did you fly in a commercial aircraft or a 141 or...?
No, it was, it had to have been commercial because we went into the capital. No, it was military, as I recall.
And you were PCSing by yourself, so there,
yes.
You didn't have anyone from, any other pilots from Homestead that were
no.
joining you on this thing?
No.
And so I know that some of the commercial aircraft brought in, I think they left, you know, I guess they left out of several different places in California, stopped in Hawaii, and then went straight into Da Nang. Does that sound like what you did, or did you have several stops along the way to get to Vietnam?
No, I remember going into the capital, and then you were airlifted out of there, and...
Oh, in the
130s or whatever.
In the Saigon?
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
yeah,
I guess
that's what it was. It's commercial, I think, in Saigon.
Well, I was going to ask you. I don't know how well you remember it or anything, but I always like to see if they do. Is a lot of the folks when they're going in on these commercial aircraft, they're, you know, it's obviously packed with GIs, and
yeah.
And 99% of them have never been in a war zone before. So do you recall what the mood was on the airplane at all going in?
No, I don't really. That's why I think it's commercial.
Yeah.
It took us in there. Now, I know we went in C-130 or whatever, going up to Da Nang, and then settling down to the F-4 business.
So did you have somebody from your unit meet you down there in Saigon, or was it, you know, you just walked around with your orders going, hey, I'm supposed to head up to Da Nang, does anyone know how I get there?
Yeah, it was just orders, and they, you know, that thing's going back and forth several times a day, as far as C-130s or whatever they were shoveling people out from the capital.
Huh. So you didn't have to wait, you didn't spend any time in Saigon, you just found your bag and drug it across a ramp to the C-130 somewhere?
Yeah.
Okay. So when you first get over to Da Nang, do you know any of the folks that are in the unit?
I knew a few of them, yes. That's why I say the one fellow, that's an old friend of mine, he's the one that said, why don't you tell the boss you want to take over my job? And that's where he took off back home and I took his job. And it was a good outfit, I mean. Dust F4s and so on.
Well, that was in 1971. And
yeah.
And so the F4 was still, well, you might have still had the new car smell in it.
Yeah, well, they're F4Es, so they were pretty new.
Yeah. As you got into the unit, you became the maintenance officer. Did you have to go back to go to maintenance school for that, or
no? Because I had two maintenance officers.
Okay.
That were all schooled on that, and like I said, the super guys, and with the airman of the month that I started, the airman of the month would get a ride with me on my test tops.
I think I saw something on your questionnaire. You wrote something about that. I can't find it in front of me right now, but you said there was an interesting flight on one of your test tops.
Yeah, well, it was what the one I probably mentioned was. It was a big, tall black fellow that just happened to get Airman of the Month, and he must have been 6'2" or so, big fellow. And they had to strap him in. My ground chief, crew chief, he was that big, and we had straps in the F4, as you recall, and legs and arms and chest and everything. And what I would do is, only for them, I'd give them a gee-whiz ride and take the F4 down the runway, gear up, and keep that sucker on the ground until about 400, and then give them a vertical and a roll. And his comment was, I heard him from the back seat, said, oh, man, that's better than a trip. And I thought, better than a trip? Wait a minute. What's he on?
Yeah.
And didn't bother me in the least, because they were doing their job and doing it shit hot well, and we used to have wing maintenance periodic. You'd get rid of your airplanes and go to wing to have them done over. And my two captains came to me one day and said, hey, we'd like to do something, boss. And I said, what's that? Do our own periodic maintenance. I said, we're in a war. You're working 12 hours a day, and you want to take over a wing job? I'll make a long story short. We took it. We got to the point for, we were very proud of, for 10 days, we had zero write-ups. All our airplanes were 100% OR. That lasted about 18 days. And I get nothing but, from the other chief of maintenance, you know, that weren't rated. What the hell are you doing over there? We got her on the tip, and that was indeed a pleasure. Hornblower, too. But the other half of it was, the wing commander would never let me go back to the flight line with the rest of the troops. Even though I was flying combat and everything else, he said, no, you got maintenance. You're doing it well, and he wants you to stay there. So that was fun.
Wow. So, there's not very many units in combat or out of combat that can say they had 100% aircraft availability for 18 days.
Yeah.
I bet that's not happening even in the smaller detachments.
Well, it was the guys, it wasn't I. They did it beautifully.
So, outside of your maintenance world, in the operational side, 1970, things are, we've started this big Vietnamization of the war, and we're trying to transition a lot of stuff. What was that like?
Well, originally, I had an offer to... Oh, that's getting ahead of myself. Coming back from Vietnam, we ended up coming back here, as you recall. That was 72 to 75. And I ended up at the right back here at the University of Arizona for Commandant of Cadets.
I did see that.
And as you well know, great job, great young people, just like you and your bride. Was that on that one, or was that on the second one?
I think it was on the second. You were the assistant PAS. But let's go back to Vietnam for a minute. The Vietnamization of the war, and we're supposed to be transitioning the combat mission from the U.S. troops by the end of the summer. So that's about the time. Let me look at my timeline here. So that's right in. That's exactly when you get there on the. Is it the 15th of July? It looks like I'm looking at these. Make sure I have my dates right. Was it somewhere in July of 1971? That's smack in the middle of when they were trying to do that transition over to the South Vietnamese military. Did you have any insight into that to see how that was going?
Well, I was there when the B-52s were heading north. And we would even have alerts at Da Nang and over in Thailand. And we would sit alert. In fact, I set up the one over in Thailand at U Dorn. This is just before they went to the MAS 52s going north. They were still going north, but they were doing it at night when I was there.
And was this the linebacker operation?
Yes.
Okay.
There's linebacker one and two.
Okay, that's what I was going to ask you. Were you there for both of them?
And yes.
It sounds like maybe you were.
I was there for linebacker one. I think two came shortly after I came back here.
So you know what? You're absolutely right. Linebacker two was in December 1972, so you had just returned.
So what we would do, and when I was at Da Nang, there was nothing at U Dorn as far as our aircraft, our wing aircraft. So the boss asked me to go over and set up a alert pad at U Dorn, which I did, and we would sit there and hold alert, or fly our normal missions at night whenever they needed us, and it worked out very well. I remember one day sitting alert, and we get launched for a B-52 escort, and it was a beautiful day, and it's a two ship that we had for escort. And we launch, and my wingman, they lead, slowed down. I don't know if I told you that, but in any event, he slowed down. I looked back, and he's just slowly coming up onto my wing. And his back seat is, canopy is gone. And I said, holy, what the hell? And I said, never mind, stand by. So I called the B-52 guys or whoever was directing us to them. And I said, we're going to have to abort. But I launched with second. The other two that were sitting a little with me, I told them to launch those two because we're not going to be able to meet the B-52. So they launched them. And meanwhile, I'm thinking, what the hell is going on here? And I came to the conclusion that the dumb shit backseater that he had didn't have the canopy locked. And Mother Nature just, boom, knocked the canopy right off.
Wow.
And you're in the afterburner and you're coming out at 300 knots or so. In any event, I thought, as a good maintenance man, what I should do is just put both of us back on the ground and you know, get new canopies or whatever. And I thought, I don't think so. And what I did was keep the guy on my wing. And I toured all over Thailand. It was a beautiful day. And that guy had his head, the back seater, leaning forward, and he couldn't go back into the seat to save his soul. And I thought, we came back from debrief after about an hour or so. I said, anybody learn anything today? That was the end of that briefing.
He probably never took off with the canopy not latched again.
Wow. Oh, fun and games.
I was curious. I sent you that that piece from the archives that I found on VF4 spraying Agent Orange. I guess some sort of herbicide. What was that something that did you get a chance to read that? I thought that was very interesting.
Oh, I didn't catch that. That was a long one there. I'll go back and review it.
Yeah, it was.
But I was watching that for about 45 minutes today.
that was the video. Was that the video?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was a little fun thing I saw. I had actually seen that years ago, and I stumbled on that when I was doing a little bit of your unit research.
Oh,
and,
okay.
I thought that was pretty good. A friend of mine, it was an F4 guy, and he sent that to me several years ago, I think they may have made that after Vietnam, but I think some of the footage may have come from Vietnam.
Yeah, I scanned a couple, and one was down for 45 minutes or something. I thought, I can't do this. I got to talk to John.
So,
I went through three or four of them.
Let me go back to Udorn here real quick. Wasn't that where that was where the triple nickel was, right?
Yes.
And so, did you get a chance to interact with those folks over there?
Not much, because what I did was I went to set it up, and the boss gave me so much time, and I think he thought I was going to be there for about a short time, just get set up, you know, maintenance and the unit and so on. And so I said, when he called, he said, how are you doing? I said, I'll be back in about probably a week or so. Oh, my needs are back here. Said, okay. He gets somebody to set up then, and he sent somebody else over, and I went back to Da Nang. So I was only there probably 2-3 weeks. And then we rotated the thing for the rest of the year. But we did many different things, not only alert, but even back home we were doing different things, air to ground. We didn't do any air to air. We did night flying back at Da Nang, long flights, sometimes 4 or 5 hours. And what it was, we ran cover on gunships, C-130s.
Uh-huh.
So it's a long night. You launch about 10 in the evening, and probably get back at 3 or 4 in the morning. And it's an edit for a short story. It's kind of a ho-hum job, you know. You're up at F4 altitude, and C-130 is down in the boondocks there, strafing gunships, they were called. And one night I'm sitting up there, ho-hum, going in a circle, and watching down at him, his cover. And I see AAA coming up, and it's way the hell due east of me, or something like that. And I said, hey, Gunny, is he bothering you? No. Yeah. So I keep orbiting and orbiting, and all of a sudden I notice that AAA is coming a little closer. Finally, dawn on me, shit, he's shooting at me. But he was way behind, you know, in the beginning, like I said, maybe 180 degrees across, and all of a sudden it went to 160 or whatever. In any event, I said to Gunny, hey, I think that guy's after me. I said, you going to be okay for him? Oh, yeah, go ahead, do whatever you got to do. So I did a smart over the head and down and flew down and so on, and dropped 3 Mark 82s on him, at least where they see it, where it's coming from. And to this day, I hope he's up in heaven someplace.
Huh.
But he definitely never came up again.
Wow. Well, he probably wasn't, he was probably trying to track you visually.
Yeah.
You had all your lights off, I assume.
He hoped her. Yeah,
so.
Exactly.
Huh. And he just was doing the best he can, trying to figure out where you were coming and going. And what altitude were you at when you were doing your orbits?
We were probably up around 20, 18, 20, something like that.
So
gunships down at, I don't know, it goes 1,500 up to 3,500 or whatever.
So he was probably always shooting behind you.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Well, just a couple more questions on your Vietnam experience. The F-4 was a great machine, and it really made a name for itself. There were a lot of, I know there were a lot of incidents. There was F-4 shot down. Did you have any of those where any of your guys were on those missions when you were flying? Maybe you were listening to the recovery, or maybe supporting some sort of a rescue operation?
No, and I think the reason was we did not go up north very often. The 52s did, but remember when they stopped there in the early parts of the negotiation,
mm-hmm.
they cut off going north. We did.
That's right.
In the fighter business. And that was about it. I were in cover on one up near the DMZ. Or what do they call it, six or something like that, where he was on a recce, and we would escort recces. But that's the only thing that times we'd get up north, and they didn't go up into high route pack six or something, or the lower route packs that they would be taking visual coverage, checking out what was going on sunny days or whatever else.
Right. Did, so when all the, when the linebacker one mission was going on, did you get a feel for how things were going on the ground? I mean, were you able to, did you have any Vietnamese officers or that you interacted with for planning or anything like that to get a feel for how they were handling the taking more of the combat role on?
No, not to my knowledge. The all the time our escorts were with the gunships, and that's day and night. And it's always in country, or as far north as we've gone a couple times up north, and it's usually at night time. And when this stuff comes up, escort, we fire off and then escort the 130 back out of, or the Navy, if that's who we're escorting, to get them out of the area.
Right.
And, but you don't see any, you can't identify if you were successful or not, because you dump and then you follow the gunship. Because you got to stay with him.
Yeah. Took all the fun out of it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I know that in 1971, I don't know when, but I just remembered that it may have been either just before, it may have concluded before you got there, or it may have been right after you left, but I think Bob Hope had a big Christmas show there at Da Nang, didn't he?
I remember talking about that, but I don't think it was. I don't think I was there for that.
Okay.
No, because I never saw Hope over there.
That's too bad, because you know he brought Anne Margaret and. You
oh
know,
God, yes.
Did you get any USO shows or anything? You know, maybe not the big one like Bob Hope, but did you get any type of recreational time when you were over there?
No, did not. Perfectly honest with you.
Just too busy.
What we did in the beginning when I first got there, we could go to the beach. And, you know, you just take a maintenance truck or whatever, and you don't stop in town. You just go to and from the beach. And the beach was...
Was that China Beach?
China Beach.
Okay.
Yeah. And that was guarded by the GIs and so on. He even had gates he went through to get to the beach. So that was essentially roped off for military-only type thing.
Mm-hmm. So
but they quit that about 2 to 3 weeks after I got there, because they had some problems with the trucks going to and from and people making passes at them or something.
Well, yeah, I imagine things were probably, I imagine things on the ground were probably starting to deteriorate depending on where you transferred the mission over to the folks on the ground.
Yes, yes.
So I could see where there could be a security situation developing at that point.
Well, we had Marines also at Da Nang, so they're kind of pretty good for help, as you can imagine.
Well, in fact, one of the fellow that I was talking to before, he one of his jobs was security around Da Nang Air Base for a while. I think they had actually moved him back to take over that with his platoon. I think he was down there for a month or two, if I remember right.
Yeah. Well, we get incoming at night. Occasionally. And the Marines, of course, were in charge of the local area. But the bad guys would post their guns or whatever, rockets, and get them someplace during the day, but time them so they don't go off until night. So anytime we were taking incoming at Da Nang, it was during the night. And I mentioned going over to Udorn, setting up over there. While I was there, Da Nang took a pretty good hit. And I came back, and we had dorms there, you know, two-story type things for the pilots and so on. In one corner of one of those things, it was the building next to the one I had, was sleeping in. And it took off the northwest corner of the building and took out a few people upstairs. The guy downstairs, where the thing lands, he came out smelling like a rose. The wall caved in, a little bit of the ceiling, but it covered him up very safely, whereas the rest of the blast, you know, goes out like a balloon thing. And the people upstairs are the ones who really took the hit. The whole corner of the building was gone.
I'll be darned. Did they destroy any aircraft?
No. We lucked out.
I think I remember seeing it when I was doing a little bit of the unit research. I remember seeing a picture of the ramp at Da Nang. They had about four or five C-130s that were essentially completely destroyed. They were just the hulks.
Yeah, they were down at the other end we were on the east side of the runway, and the 130s, I think, were over near where the Marines were, and that's the other side of the runway. But that was the only hit that I recall. Was, and I wasn't there when it hit. So.
But it was a fairly regular occurrence to have these rocket attacks?
Yeah, probably on a bi-weekly basis.
Huh.
And always at night, like I said. And that's how we figured out, or gathered, how they would set them up, get the hell out of there, and they wouldn't get caught setting, I guess.
So when you got to towards the end of your rotation there in Da Nang,
mm-hmm.
which looks like it was in April of 1972, you know, things are definitely starting to wind down. The linebacker operation was pretty successful, and you know, I'm pretty sure they're all talking about how everyone will be home by Christmas.
Yeah,
because it seems like that's a common theme through the years. And so, did you feel like that there was a big change in the op tempo from when you had first arrived on station?
Oh yes, I did, because it was calming down, and you weren't getting the forces moving forward and aft as they had been in the past.
Hmm.
And when you get to that point, you're in the countdown mode, and you become a little disinterested as far as things calming down. You'd rather stay busy.
Yeah. Did you get a mid-tour mid-tour leave when you were there, or did you have to stay there the whole time?
We did, I know Joan came over when I was in Korea to Hawaii. Let me see if, just a second. Okay, I just wanted to clear that other half up. You hear the rest of the story?
I didn't hear that.
Yes, we had a week in Hawaii.
Okay, that's what I was going to say. A lot of folks seem to go to Hawaii for that, or Australia. It seemed like they were able to meet. So I was just curious. All right, good.
No, my honey and I managed to do it.
All right.
Hard part about that thing is going back.
The post-vacation depression kicks in quickly, I guess.
Yeah.
Either way, you have a long flight. She probably had a longer flight than you did. All right, so you get to April. Do you remember coming home? Was that on a commercial aircraft, or was that on a military aircraft?
No, that was commercial.
So what do you remember what that was like, rolling down the runway and, you know, hearing the gear slap up into the well and...
Yeah, a few yells here and there, and hoop-dee-da.
So it was a fairly happy atmosphere, I imagine, on the airplane.
Oh yeah, labor of love at that point.
Where did you land once you got into the continental United States?
Well, let me see. It had to have been the West Coast. I forget just where. Of course. Joan and the kids were here in Tucson. And,
so you went...
Or were they in Florida?
Actually, you left them in Homestead.
Homestead.
And then after your tour, that's when you went to U of A, so they may have met you there in Tucson.
Yeah, I think that's right.
So...
Second. My honey just came in.
Coming back to Vietnam, years over here, and I came into work with her.
Yes, it was all fitting clothes, and the family was here, and they met me at the airport.
All right. You spent a good bit of your career in the Tucson area, haven't you?
You got it. Like I said in the beginning, when we first got to Verona, I said, hey, this is the place to be.
Yeah.
And that started right there.
So when you got back from Vietnam, you know, I think sometimes for the Air Force guys, it's a little bit different than maybe, you know, the Army folks or the Marines that are out there, you know, constantly under an artillery burst going off. Did it take you a while to decompress, to kind of get out of that the war zone mentality?
I have to say yes, but not in a, you know, a hoopty doubt type thing. It was a great place as far as work and flying.
Yeah.
But I never really had any interest in going back. Except you remember our son Kevin.
Yeah.
We were headed once about 3 or 4 years ago. That he was going over and he was going to take me for my birthday. And I said, Kevin, there's a rumor afoot that you're going to take me back to Vietnam. I said, Vietnam in July is not my cup of tea.
You might probably want to hit the cooler, drier months.
Well, yes, exactly. But as you know, 2 or 3, 4 years later, Da Nang got selected as one of the four newest golf courses in the world. I don't know if you ever read that story, but
I haven't. But I have heard that Da Nang has become a little bit of a tourist attraction.
Exactly.
Huh.
And the place where we used to go to the beach when I first got there, that whole area has been taken over, and evidently the golf course. I vaguely remember a golf course there, but I never played any. None of us did.
Well, you're going to have trouble if you go back there now with Joan, because she's going to say, "Well, this is where you were at war, because this looks like a resort."
What's wrong with that, huh?
Wow. Well, that's it's interesting the way there's been a few people that I've talked to that said they never want to go back.
Yeah.
And other ones who said, "Hey, I would love to go back. I would love to go see what that looked like, and see what the people are like." So I guess everyone has their own different experience. The last fellow I talked to, he was saying that when he returned from Vietnam, it was a commercial thing, and he said by the time he only spent about 12 hours there, they out-processed him, and he was in his civilian clothes, and he said his mom and dad picked him up, and he said the thing he couldn't get over for about 2 weeks was how loud everything was, because he said out there you had to be quiet, you had to be able to listen to the incoming artillery or the mortar rounds going off, and he said I couldn't stand how loud it was when I got back. He said it took him months to get that kind of out of his head, that it wasn't as loud as he thought.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I know the Air Force is a little bit different environment, because you're riding those Pratt & Whitney's, and it's a different atmosphere.
You
but,
got it.
So you came back to, let me check my time here real quick. Oh, we got a couple minutes. So you came back from Vietnam, the families joined you in Tucson, and you're going to be the assistant PAS at the University of Arizona, it looks like.
Yes.
All right.
Exactly.
So you're kind of, so not only are you having a Tucson thread here throughout your life and your career, but evidently ROTC is becoming a common thread throughout your life and your career as well.
Yes. Yeah. The one thing I recall, the biggest thing, coming back and getting in the ROTC business was your PAS at that time, his name again slips me, he asked me what I thought about not wearing the uniform on campus because of, you know, what the campus was like in those days. And he said the Navy's already doing it and the Army's doing it. And I said, you know, uniform is representative of a military education. And I heard what's going on back in the States as far as anti-military and so on. But it says, as far as I'm concerned, the uniform represents the Navy, the Air Force, and Army. And as such, we should be advertising what we really are instead of hiding. And he allowed that was true. And we never took the uniform off here at U of A in the Air Force, ROTC. Now, how that went down at the university, I don't know.
Huh. Well, I was just curious. That I usually ask this, but maybe I should have asked you on this. A lot of folks, when they come back, the last fellow I just interviewed, they landed in a commercial aircraft at LAX, and before they left the aircraft, a LA cop walks onto the aircraft and he says, "I want you all to know that there's people outside the airport that are going to protest, and they're going to spit on you, they might throw things at you, and I'm just going to tell you right now, if you get in a fight with them, I will arrest you, not them."
Holy gee.
And so they were warned, and they were actually let off, kind of off the side, so they tried to, they did what they could to try and avoid it, but at LAX, evidently, there was quite a bit of that. And other folks had gotten off, the guy before that got off in Seattle, and he said, "I don't think anyone even realized that people were leaving the Vietnam from there." And so I guess everyone had different experiences on, some had some pretty difficult experiences where they were called names and things, and other people didn't. But I was just curious, once you got on the University of Arizona, Tucson back in those days was a little bit smaller town and probably a little more rural.
A little more conservative.
That's what you've got the U of A mall there that always has different kind of life cultures growing out there. So maybe you did run into something there. Did you get any negative experiences when you?
No, never did. No, I saw nothing but positives there.
Good. How about any of the cadets, any of the students going through? Did they ever tell you about any problems they had?
No. Well, the one problem we had was what the commander did. Remember, your honey, I made commander.
Oh, that's right. Now, that I was talking about your first time through there. But I do remember that. We could save that one for tomorrow.
Okay, I think that's a good idea.
Maybe we'll both forget it by then.
I'm an easy forgetter.
But the so it's interesting though that the PAS had that discussion with you. Were you a lieutenant colonel then when you arrived for your first assignment at U of A?
No, I was a major then.
Still a major. So
yeah.
So he had that frank discussion with you, and evidently you swayed him enough that they decided to keep doing that. But he must have thought there was a reason to do it.
Yeah.
But evidently nothing showed up. So.
But it sold.
Yeah.
It worked out all right.
So you're in Tucson. Just out of curiosity, were you living downtown or were you living on base?
No, we're on the economy here.
Okay. So were you in? The house that you're living in now, was that where you were living back then, or is it?
No, we had campus. Two other places here in town that we've lived.
Okay.
We never built here until 92, I think it was.
Okay. And so anything significant out of your first assignment at the University of Arizona?
Pardon me?
What? Am I losing you again? Doggone it. Was there... How's
we
that?
We lived on a place in Visco. We built a house on Disco, which is...
I remember that one.
Yeah.
Okay. I remember that road, anyway.
Yeah.
So, as an assistant PAS, Colonel Fitzsimmons, did you have any significant, was there something significant that you remember from your first assignment at U of A?
No, I thought it was very educational from both our ends, and a good group, and the kids were good. PAS was a super guy, and enjoyed working with all of them.
I'm making a little bit of a note here because we're going to end this here in just a moment.
Okay.
But you had two tours at the University of Arizona doing Air Force ROTC. And so tomorrow I'm going to ask you, that's a lot of people that went through the United States Air Force, from some just a few years, others with probably went on with remarkable military careers. And so I'd like to hear about some of those thoughts, you know, from both of your assignments.
Yes. Well, we'll have a couple more funnies like the one we just talked about.
Sure.
Your bride.
Well, we're just, you know, when you're dealing with the human condition, you know, you're going to have some of these things, and I think you were the right guy at the right place for a lot of those. That's for sure. Well, I tell you what, Colonel Fitzsimmons, I'm gonna turn the recording off here in just a moment, but we're going to go from your first assignment at U of A, and you're going to go from there to Maxwell Air Force Base, it looks like.
Yeah.
And so we'll pick that up there tomorrow morning. If you give me just a second, I'm going to turn this off. Right. Oh, this is John McGonigal with the Vietnam Archives at Texas Tech University conducting an oral history on Colonel James M. Fitzsimmons. This is part two of our interview. Today is 5 November 2015. I'm in Lubbock, Texas at the Special Collections Library on the campus of Texas Tech, and Colonel Fitzsimmons is joining me by phone from Tucson, Arizona. Good morning, Colonel Fitzsimmons.
Good morning back there.
hey, I was going through my notes on part one, and I noticed that I forgot to ask a question about your bride. We talked a little bit about how you met in high school, or maybe even before that, and then we don't talk about her until you graduate college and you get married. So there's a little gap there that she was doing something in her life, and I'd like to just capture that.
Okay. I'll go to the point of where I first met her, and she was a run-up queen, harvest queen, for the city county of Rochester, and I was asked by a friend of mine to date his girlfriend because he was up in the University of Buffalo and couldn't get down there. So that would have been probably
51, 52, something like that, I'm thinking.
Yeah. In any event, that's when I first saw Joan, and I said to this girl that I was dating, or for my friend, and she told me who she was and introduced me, and from then on in, we were dating. And the rest of it, I think you know, we talked about dating while I was at the university then, and talked about meeting her parents and so on. Now, she went off to New York School of Interior Design, and that was when I was working on the railroad.
Okay.
And I had free trips to go there if I so desired, and obviously I did. I went down and visited her once or twice in the city of New York, where she was doing her learning curve on School of Interior Design. So she finished there, and I finished, then I ended up going to college, and then we got married after graduation, and we've been living happily ever after. We just had our 60th wedding anniversary on the 29th of October.
All right, 60 years. Awesome. Well, I guess it's going to stick.
Pardon me?
I guess it's going to stick then. You guys will stay together, I guess.
And as an interior decorator, she obviously didn't get much time to practice her forte, but with us in service and moving so many times, she was redecorating every time we moved. So
well, and
she got lots of practice.
Potentially with this this
military housing.
Well, and with your recent water damage situation there in Tucson.
Hey, she's got me a list right here that got to call them when we finish phoning.
So this may be the ultimate part of her design career going on right now.
You better honk.
Awesome. All right, good. I'm glad I was able to capture that. And then going back now, and I hate to drag you back because we're all the way through that first assignment after Vietnam, but I noticed in your records here we have a very specific Distinguished Flying Cross Award that was given to you on 11 September 1971, and I was wondering if you could recall what generated some of this paperwork.
Well, if you recall, I mentioned that we did a lot of work with the gunships, and I don't know if I told you the story of the one at night, but we also went north with them as a guide when they were doing their job, the gunship, because there'd be troops in contact and so on.
Right.
And that one in North Vietnam, again, a low altitude type thing, but the gunship that we were escorting, again, we were at an altitude primarily, but not as high as we were on the night things. We were lower, right with them. And it came up, and the gunship, as I recall, took a couple of hits, and we had to escort him back. And we took care of the bad guys first, but again, we got him back safely as far as coming back to DM. Not DM, I mean Da Nang.
Da Nang, all right.
And that was, I think that was essentially what that was all about.
Awesome. And I also see that you had through a fifth oak leaf cluster on the air medal. It looks like for probably the same, or around the same time period, from July of 1971 to 21 April 1972. Can you describe those?
Yeah, the DFC there, air medal and five devices, whatever they, meritorious service medal and so on.
What? Was the air medal for these air medal operation awards, were they for similar type escort missions? Okay,
yes.
I gotcha. And evidently the one for the Distinguished Flying Cross was a escort mission. Obviously a lot more work involved in that one once a gunship gets hit.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Excellent. I think it's interesting, your Distinguished Flying Cross, I just happened to notice 11 September, you know, is up to this point in time in our lives, you know, 11 September is kind of an interesting date. So it goes back. 11 September seems to be repeating even in 1971. So, anyway, I thought that was interesting. So so we came out of Vietnam and we went, you were assistant PAS at Tucson at the University of Arizona. And we kind of finished up there, and you're packing the family up again, and you're moving them out to Montgomery, Alabama, it looks like, for Air War College.
That is correct.
So what was that assignment like?
Well, it's a standard military school as far as that's concerned, but it's very educational also. And that was Montgomery, Alabama, and our boys were with us. As a matter of fact, our mid-son, Timothy, liked that Montgomery area so well that he went to Auburn when we left there.
Oh.
And got his degree at Auburn in engineering. And the school was very good, very educational. And from there, we ended up back down in Florida.
You went to the
headquarters of the
Tactical Air Warfare Center?
Tactical Air Warfare Center is correct.
All right, and that was about 1976 then,
mm-hmm.
that you're down there. And that's, is that at Eglin Air Force Base?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you finally got back to where you first touched down in that DC-3 from your first PAS at Rochester. Flew you down there. So did you happen to rethink about that?
Yes, we did. Yeah, and we bought a home down there, as a matter of fact. And it was headquarters for all that good stuff. And I was still current, at least in the T-38. And they had 38s down there for another program. And I went down there and said, "Hey, you need an old guy like me to fly 38s with you?" And they said, "Well, no, we're pretty well filled up." But they let me fly a, what was it, 4, 6, 8 passenger twin engine.
Like a Learjet type, the C-21?
Yes, was that a passenger type thing?
I think so, yeah, it's like a little Learjet, like a little business jet.
Yeah, with twin engines and so on, yes. And they were on the fuselage.
Yep, that sounds right.
That was it. So I got back into flying, at least, in addition to the job that I had there. And stayed current in that for a while, carrying people around.
All right.
And I think the end came when I made 06 there. And they didn't need, you know, old sixes flying their airplanes.
Well, that's
a great job.
I'm sure you've heard that joke where, I mean, it's not really a joke, but they say when you make major, they take away your brain, and when you make lieutenant colonel, they take away your voice, and then when you make colonel, they give you your voice back.
I think that's very appropriate. Yeah, fairly.
So you made 06, you're down at the Air Warfare Center, and it looks like you are going back overseas now.
Yes. From that thing, we were there a few years. Like I say, we even bought a place there. Our younger troops were going to school. Like I said, Tim had already started Auburn, so he was the middle guy. Our oldest was right here at the University of Arizona. The youngest one was with us, obviously, Christopher. And yes, what happened thereafter was they had me scheduled for a slot back into Korea. And I said, "Wait a minute, Korea?" I said, "I've had a couple tours there, you know, people talking to the Pentagon or whatever." And I went to the commander there, as I recall, and I said, "They've got me alerted for a tour in Korea, and it was going to be, you know, post-hastily type thing." And he said, "You've been to Korea?" In any event, this two-star evidently went to somebody up there in the Pentagon to see if this is all quite true. And they said, "Yeah, but they delayed it and gave me a different job in Korea." It was at the headquarters and the embassy. And so I said, "Hey, I can live with that, I guess," because that meant the family could go with me.
Right.
The remotes that I had the other two times. So that's where we went from Eglin, went to Korea, and I went over early, and Joan and Christopher, our youngest, had to finish school. So they stayed there, and he finished high school there. And like I said, I went over remote, solo, and it was in Seoul, Korea, the embassy and the Air Force contingent there. And they came over about 4 months later. And when I was there solo in the first part, I was with the command center again, and a very interesting job because we had a contemporary Korean colonel and Koreans working with us also. So it was real headquarters, I think. Very interesting, because you're right there in Seoul. But when I was living in the Hooch with the single guys and whatever, in spare time I taught engineers from Korean Mining and Corporation, and they wanted to get squared away in speaking English. So I did that part-time, in addition to the headquarters job that I had there. And there were probably 8 or 10 of these guys. And finally, it's time for Joan and Chris to come over. And the other thing I was doing when I first got over there was trying to find housing on base. And I lucked out and found one embassy housing that was being redecorated. And it came out beautiful. So finally, Joan and Chris come over, and I had the house all ready for him. All I had to do was walk in. She ended up with a maid, a gardener, all this other stuff. And she said, "What's wrong with Korea?" And I thought, "Oh, you got to be kidding me." She couldn't believe it, how beautiful it was, and loved Seoul and everything else. She even had a maid, like I said, and she even taught cooking to some of the Korean women. So that was a very interesting tour, a little lengthy that I described. But in the, did I mention I taught the Koreans and men I taught?
Yeah.
And I was earning pretty good money in that thing, just from lots of won. And when Chris come over, he started college work. So I said, "Hey, you want a job too?" And I gave him my night job for the Korean engineers, and he started making money. I thought, "Hey, that's pretty good."
Excellent.
He's going to college and earning some money in a foreign country.
So was that English teaching, was that on base, like an on-base thing, or were you doing
this? Yes, they come on base, and they had clearance, and I did it back in the BOQ type thing, and then, of course, when we had the housing, you could do it right there on base. He didn't do it at home, but there was an area where we could do that.
And you know, just thinking while you were describing that, this is the first time you've actually been able to bring your family to an overseas assignment.
Absolutely correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
So she was probably loving that.
Oh. And then some. As I sit here with this house being flooded, I can see Korean stuff all over the place.
Yeah. I think I may have some of those. All right. So tell me a little bit about working with the Koreans. What were your thoughts on that?
It was very, very interesting, very educational as far as, you know, how the Korean military acts and the headquarters. And as you can imagine, Command Center had a lot of activity from the north. And we went on alert twice. And as a matter of fact, the second time that we had it, you know, it goes to high alert, high everything. Second time, I found out, and I would be the first to find out at the command center, that, okay, the North Koreans had backed off or whatever. So I just took the hammer and called up all the people, you know, Air Force bases and everything around South Korea. And today, we're going back to normal. It's because I just gotten that from intelligence. And said, okay, so everybody was back to normal. And the next day I get a call from the four-star there. And he said, "Good morning, Fitz, how's everything going?" And the command said, "Oh, fine, sir, fine." He said, "I understand you put us all back on regular air mode." What do they call it? The different types of operational code.
I remember they, I think there used to be sort of a DEFCON,
DEFCON, yeah. That was it, exactly, thank you. We went to a high DEFCON alert initially, and then I called them all back when I heard what was coming through Intel. And so he calls me, and the reason he calls me, and he said, "Oh, by the way, Fitz, I understand he put us back DEFCON 4 or whatever, last night? I said, yes, sir, we got the word in. He said, well, that was very good, but hey, Fitz, remember, that's really my job. So it was a, you know, kick in the ass type thing from the old man, and but he did it very, very well. And I walked out, and I thought, I didn't think of that until I walked out, and I thought, wait a minute, he just chewed my butt out because I took over his job.
Now, what was he an Air Force guy?
Yes.
Okay.
I can't think of his name right now, but yes.
Because that was a what?
The so, DEFCON Air Force DEFCON that was.
Well, I mean that was kind of a combined assignment, right? I mean, didn't you have multi-service and multinational?
Yes.
Up in that area?
But what I was doing was the Air Force, putting the Air Force guys back from DEFCON 4 to DEFCON
4. Oh, okay.
Or DEFCON 1 to DEFCON 4.
I gotcha. Well, in you know, in 1979 in Korea, if I remember right, I might have my date wrong, but there was a, wasn't there a sort of like an attempted coup or something at that time frame, around 78, 79?
Yes. Yes, there was.
So what?
And I forget who got the...
Yeah, I can't remember much about it.
I think somebody got shot. I don't recall. I'm sorry. My memory is not the best.
But you remember the, you know, that happening. And,
yes.
And so I was just curious that, you know, I could see where the Koreans might overreact or have a situation develop. Did it seem like things calmed down after that, or did we?
Well, the one I was talking about was the one where they, the North Koreans were getting a little feisty.
Okay.
But when the presidential thing happened, that was more in-house type thing. And that might have been another increase in DEFCON, but not to the point where the first one we had was pretty serious.
Yeah. Well, having been in Korea then for 3 times, and one of them in a pretty high position in the architecture there, and the command architecture in Korea, what's your thoughts on what you're seeing today? And you know, since you've left Korea, you know, do you think you know what? I know that there's a lot of discussion about the younger South Koreans are feeling a little bit like they did in Germany, like, hey, why don't we, you know, tear down that wall? Why don't we talk unification, that kind of stuff? Where the older Koreans probably not quite ready for something like that. Do you see something like that happening over there?
Not at this particular time. South Korea, or our Korea, is really pulled themselves up by the bootstraps. And I understand Seoul, Korea, you wouldn't even believe what it looks like today. And the people have pulled themselves up by the bootstrap, and it's highly commercialized. I think the younger generation has a tendency to try and do just that. And I read recently where they'd opened up the door for Koreans to go visit their relatives in North Korea, which I think is a positive step as far as you know, them coming together. But with the atomic stuff that North Korea has, I don't see anything jumping out like Germany with a wall. I could be wrong.
Yeah. Well, since we're talking about Korea, and before we move forward, you know, if you were alive during this, and your brother participated in the Korean War,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if you recall that much. General MacArthur and President Truman and their controversy, but you know, that's something that played out for the next couple decades, at least for as far as the U.S. military and limited war campaigns.
Yeah.
What's your thoughts on how that how that went down with MacArthur and Truman and the controversy that developed there?
Well, MacArthur was a rather opinionated fellow, and a very good warrior for sure, as far as keeping us going in the right direction. But and yes, they were far apart for sure. With MacArthur, I think, making some command decisions that Truman wasn't too happy with. But that, by the time I was over there for that last call, that wasn't much of an issue. Even though we're still North Korea getting all their atomic stuff and not doing very well for their own people. It's definitely a military regime to the nth degree.
Mm-hmm.
And as you know, we've had other people that went up there for just reasons of trying to learn something about in-house North Korea. And some of them getting put in the pokey.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's loosening as far as the people of South Korea wanting to, as you infer, can't we get over this, you know, Korean War crap and come together? But with that little guy that's running up north, I don't think there's open ears to that.
Yeah, it seems like he's hanging on there, and you know, there was a time this just recently that, you know, he sort of dropped out of the public for a month or so, and I think maybe people were speculating that possibly there was some sort of coup that went on, or he was ill. And
I think I bought off on the ill thing. It was just my opinion.
Well, and, I guess he resurfaced, though, a month or two later, and
yeah.
I guess we're just back to where we were.
Yeah.
But, well, it was interesting, and I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that Truman-MacArthur thing. The, you know, that, even though it was an odd situation where Truman, evidently, his poll numbers weren't that great, and, of course, MacArthur being a national icon after World War II,
yeah.
It definitely seemed like it. Well, I've heard some people actually say that it was a constitutional crisis with the with the civilian, you know, supremacy of control over the military, and obviously we've gotten past that. But this whole limited war thing, you know, and which of course took on and went on in Vietnam and many times since then, that you know, there's no more unconditional surrender like we had in World War II. Everything is going to be this limited war, evidently. So it's a Truman and MacArthur were on the cusp of that thing, and I'm not sure they realized it at the time. It would have been nice if they could have sat at the table and maybe provided a little more fidelity for us, that we're going to have to deal with that down the road.
You got you right. Well, I have a grandson. That's my oldest boy, one of his sons. Finally decided had a little interest in the military, and I took him down to U of A when he was in his senior in high school, and walked into the ROTC group, and as we know, I took another job, but this was after I retired. I took him down to the ROTC, Air Force ROTC, and talked to the commander and said, hey, could you give a cadet or two and give my grandson here Cook's tour to the university? Oh, yeah, sure. So I took him down there, and there's these two young cadets, one boy, one girl, and they took him for a complete tour of U of A. And he gets back in the truck, and he says, oh, Grandpa, he says, that was super. And tongue-in-cheek, I thought, maybe we got a hook in him, and he'll go Air Force ROTC and go fly airplanes. Well, we go on back to New York, as you know. We spend summers up there, and we come back in the fall. And he's already started at the U of A. And he says to me, Grandpa, guess what? I said, what's that, Patrick? I joined ROTC. I said, oh, super. He said, yeah, and about, but I took Army this time. I said, I went, duh. I mean, In any event, he went Army ROTC, and according to his commander, who I talked to a couple of times, he majored in Army ROTC. I mean, he just thought everything was great. Long and the short of it, he graduated. He went to helicopter school. I went down and pinned his wings on him when he graduated. And he's still on active duty right now up in Alaska.
Excellent.
And he went to over to Iraq and Afghanistan and, you know, got a mouthful of that stuff. And his comment to me was, "You shouldn't be there." And I thought, wow. And the more I thought it over, I thought, you know, when we went to Iraq and Afghanistan and that stuff, even though I appreciate our great president at that time, I think it over and over, and I think we ought to get out of there somehow, or shouldn't have gone there in the first place. But that's just an opinion.
Well, you know, that's exactly where we go back to this Truman MacArthur thing. Is, you know, I think most of the folks that spend that time at that tactical level, you know, they look at limited war as kind of being like a little bit pregnant, and so there's always seems to be this miscompare from the national military strategy down to the guys that are actually sitting on the ramp.
You've been there, you know, and that's the opinion I got from him, and the more I thought of it, I thought, you know, I think we sometimes get our nose into places that we don't really need to.
Yeah, it's definitely hard to see the strategic impact of some of those. I'm thinking.
Good. Very good point.
At least at the tactical level, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, and your grandson's name? The one that's flying helicopters?
Oh, Patrick.
Patrick. Just want to make sure I had that for the record. All right, so let's go back to, so we're in Korea. We're having, first family, the families
get together there, yeah.
Overseas for the first time, mm-hmm. having a nice time in Korea, and it looks like from here you must have got follow-on orders to the University of Arizona.
I certainly did, and as a matter of fact, the sink over there, Air Force guy, kind of gave me a sweet pill of sorts. He knew I was headed back. And he said, "Oh, I thought you were going to go down to Osan, and he's going to be a wing commander type thing." And I thought it over and over, and I said, "No, I don't think so." And I had just about too much Korea. And so I didn't take that. I didn't know if it was a confirmed offer or even would be confirmed. And so that's when they gave me the other offer up here at the U of A as a commander. So I said, yes, I think that's where we're going. And that's how I ended up as a commander, as you well know, at the university.
And you were there for your second time as the PAS. That was about 1977, 78?
No, it was closer to 80.
Well, I know you finished in 80, I think.
76, yeah, that's correct, 76 to 80.
So, okay, so you spent 4 years there at the University of Arizona.
Yes, it was only supposed to be a three-year job, usually. And so when I thought it was time to leave, I picked up the phone and called the Pentagon, and I said, "Hey, it's about time to move on out. What kind of flying job you got for me?"
Actually, let me fix it. That was 1980 to 1984 is what that was, it looks like.
That's correct. What did I say? 76 to 80? No,
yeah, I was walking 80. You down a different road there, but I think that, so it's 80 to 84, so.
That's correct.
Okay. All right.
And anyway, I called the Pentagon and said, "What kind of flying job you got?" Well, you could hear him laugh all over the Pentagon. They said, "No, Fitz, I think what we had in mind was Director of Maintenance at Minot." I said, "Paul Harvey, good day." So that's when we gave up that. And I think I told you I threw my hat in the ring for a junior Air Force ROTC.
Well, let's, so when you go back to U of A the second time, and you were the PAS, before we get ahead of that, the what was there? Did you look at that job differently now that you were the PAS versus when you went there as an assistant PAS, probably just an instructor?
Well, certainly was, because as the main thing, the first goal was Commandant of Cadets, and you were the strict disciplinarian, so as to speak, and that was part of your job, in addition to being teaching the upperclassmen type thing. So yes, PAS, you spend a lot more time with the university people as far as well as controlling the commander of the Air Force ROTC. So you have a lot of interface with other professors and so on. And as far as the youngsters in there, Commandant of Cadets is the one that has to, you know, keep the path going as far as workouts and military bearing and all that business. So it was, you were working more with the university than you did as Commandant of Cadets.
Okay. And so I'm just looking, so you had, so this is your second time, you spent 4 years in this rotation, and I don't think it was quite 4 years on the first one, but so now you've got, you know, let's just call it 6 years of cadets have gone through, and I mean, you've got to be pretty proud of that, because I know, well, I know for a fact you know at least two of them that have that have gone through, you know, their entire, they've grown up, and they've did their entire lives. I mean, that, what, I just imagine the type of satisfaction that, that gives you to think about the impact that you had going forward, even though you were at the end of your Air Force career.
Career, yeah. Well, it's absolutely far more memorable than the first tour that I had there as Commandant of Cadets. And to see the product coming out, you know, and going on into service and so on, as you well know, it's really a bonus to, and a thank you type note, that people would continue into the military and do extremely well work, as you well know you have done, and so has your bride. Can I comment on that?
Sure. I'm kind of thinking back to that PAS at Rochester, and you know, it's just incredible to think about that. He has access to a DC-3, and he loads up all these kids and flies down to Eglin in the middle of winter in New York, and so I imagine you've had to have thought back to him, and thought, wow, what an impact that one event had on you, for sure. But I mean, a little bit of an inspiration there. I mean, did you try and emulate this fellow that was the PAS in Rochester a little bit, or was that something that you tried to follow?
Well,
I
think my tie with the National Guard, Air Guard out here in Tucson, as you well know, we got very close in with those people. And as a matter of fact, the wife and I got an invite from the Air National Guard to go to Hawaii and launch with them. And I thought that was pretty nice. And we did. I don't know if I ever brought that up or you recall it.
I don't remember that.
Yeah. And we launched with them. And of course, the jets were going over there and landing in Hawaii, and we were in the commander's C-130 or something, and they took us over there, and we had a nice tour in Hawaii, and then flew back to them also. And so we were tied in very closely, is what I'm getting at, with the Air Guard out here, and that gave us a lot more touch with students who could go out there too. as you well know, we have we had the commander's son in ROTC there. Can you remember that story? Can I buzz in on that?
Sure.
Well, as you know, you two were both doing extremely well in ROTC, and your bride was eventually vice commander of the unit. And we also had, at that time, a guard fellow who had come into Air Force ROTC, and his father was out in the guard. So you can see how closely we've been getting with those people.
Mm-hmm.
And as you recall, one day I called your future wife in and said to her, you are now, as of today, the commander of the unit. And her jaw dropped about 5 feet. But sir, I said, no buts, no sirs. You have command. Go do your job. And the reason was that young fella from the guard was a super nice young man. And what he had been doing was tutoring one of his cadets for some course that he was well-pruned in. And then he, as a commander, went off to California or something for a couple of days to some air show or something, then came back and said to the cadet that he'd been tutoring how'd everything go. Questioned him, and he'd forgotten everything that he taught him. And he's the guy that went in and took the exam for him. As you would look at it from a commander's standpoint, I'll take good care of my troops. Well, completely illegal. And he got tabbed. And that's when I called in your bride and said, you are now the commander, because the other one I had to shit can for obvious reasons.
So young Teresa Sanger assumes the commander, or the corps commander at that
time. That's correct.
I think that's what they called it. Yeah.
And without any need to know, because eventually she found out, but and did a super job in her own right. And I probably did the dumb shit thing by letting him stay in Air Force ROTC and just watch him till he graduated. And was mixed emotions about why I let the guy continue in the service, but he was a good commander, and so he screwed up. But as you well know, he did get commissioned, and is 06, and I think he made 06, didn't he?
You know, I don't know.
I think he did, and he was in fighters, and any event, that's a flip of the coin type thing. And your bride found out why and what happened.
Well, you know, as a PAS, you know, there, of course, you know, the fun thing is, you know, going out and getting your DC-3 or C-47, whatever they called it back then, and taking your kids down to Fort Walton Beach, or giving them an A-7 ride from the Tucson Air National Guard. I might be dating myself when I say A-7, because I think the last one of those I saw on a stick out in front of some base, but there's obviously more to it. You've got to make some judgment calls on people, and you seem to have a knack for that, being able to you know, look past, you know, people make mistakes, or people are human, but you seem to have a knack to be able to say, nope, this fellow's going to make it, or this gal's going to be able, she's going to be just fine, we're just going to get through.
Well, I appreciate that.
So, that's, so there's more to just giving airplane rides when you're the PAS.
You got it. You got it.
Well, so it's funny that you started at Rochester, at the University of Rochester, in this ROTC program, had a big impact on your life.
Absolutely.
And you had two assignments in ROTC while you were active duty. The other thing I find interesting is that is Tucson, Arizona, or in the Southern Arizona area there, for sure, from Marana to Tucson, has just kind of weaved itself into your life over your 30-year Air Force career.
Well, it certainly did. The interesting part was that first part, when we came from New York, in the middle of February, colder than a witch's, you know what, on the shady side of an iceberg, and came out to Tucson, Arizona, and flew airplanes. I thought, I know where I'm going, at least where I'm going to hold my hat. Then different assignments here.
Well, so we finished up at the University of Arizona, in fact, in 1984. So it could be, I noticed that that's when I actually graduated from the U of A, so I wonder if maybe I had just finally worn you out and that was the end of it, or had you been planning to retire all along?
No, it didn't wear me out because you guys are my special. I mean, God almighty, I can't be more proud of anybody than the ones that have come through there, and you all did so well. And what the hell, even my grandson, up going down there, and even though he went Army, he's still flying airplanes.
Yeah, sometimes I understand how that green, the attraction to green seems to, the Army has done a very good job in the last 15 years or so focusing on people.
And, that's true.
And
that true.
And I think these young kids that are going in, they're flocking over there, are finding that very appealing, and the Army's done pretty well with their PR campaign, I think.
Yeah.
Well, you
go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say after 1984, life's not over. We didn't just go out to the golf course for the last 30 years. What's been happening?
Well, I think you know I threw my hat in the ring after I retired for junior ROTC, and they kept sending me letters about, well, here's this school back in Podunk Junction, or here's another school over here in California, or here's another school here. And, well, we didn't want to move just for the sake of moving. And I just kept throwing the stuff away that they were sending me. And finally, my wife picks up this thing out of the basket and says, what's this junior ROTC job here in Germany? And of course, we had never been to Europe. I said, Germany? Oh, yeah. We could do that, I guess. Would you like to? So I threw my hat in the ring, and they said, you're not qualified. I said, what? Not qualified for junior ROTC after my stuff in college? No, the rules are you have to have taught junior ROTC in the United States before you're looked at for overseas assignments. I said, oh, fine. I won't say what I said then. And some other colonel got it. And about 4 months later, they give me a call, and they said, do you still want that job at Ramstein in Germany? I said, you told me I wasn't qualified. And they said, well, the fella came down with cancer, and we need somebody over there post-hastily. And said, boom. And that's how we ended up going over to Germany for junior ROTC at Ramstein. And spent 5 years over there. So that was my post-grad work in ROTC.
Now, and of course, for your family, that's, or at least for Joan, I guess everyone was probably finished. You were a little bit of an empty nester, I think, by then. So
that's correct.
So, but at least Joan was able to pull her second overseas assignment.
Yes, that is correct. Well, as a matter of fact, we spent 2 years there. 85 to 87, and then came back here, and I got involved in real estate and some other civilian jobs and so on. And the reason we came back was because her mother had a stroke, and things are pretty tough. So we came back to stay close, to at least physically and mentally, to the family, her mom and dad. And then her mother passed away, and lo and behold, I get a call from my master sergeant, who I actually hired when I was over there at the first tour. In fact, he was assistant coach for the football team, chief master sergeant, active duty, and I got to know him. I said, why don't you retire, and I'll get you a job right here, which I did, and he was with me for the first tour, super guy. Wife, and they just stayed right there and lived in at Ramstein. He calls me. He was home in California that He said, Colonel Fitz, hey, how about coming back to Germany with Ramstein, ROTC? I said, Chief, what makes you think the principal wants my ass back after I left after only 2 years? He said, no, I've already talked to him. The guy's leaving. He's going back to the States, and they want you here. I said, to Joan, do you want to go back to Germany? Boom, we went back for 3 more years. So that's how I ended up with the 5 years. We were there from 89 to 92.
Oh, that's incredible. I didn't realize that you had a break in there. You came back and then went back out again. Wow. Now, were you living in the same house all that, at this point, the house that you're in right now,
No, we've lived in several houses here in Tucson.
Okay.
And we bought one, I forget when we did it, the first go at ROTC. We lived over on Pinnacle. In any event, we built a house over there, and because that's when I think I made, that's immaterial, I was promoted. And so, yes, we've lived in several places here, and this one that we're in now, we built in 92 when we came back from Germany.
Okay.
Part of that real estate, I'd worked for an agent, and I bought 2 lots up here. Way back when.
Now, what was the call to real estate? Was that, I know your dad, you mentioned your dad did that for a while.
Yeah.
Actually, for quite a while.
Well, that's why I wanted to at least, you know, take a job in real estate and see what dad was like, what he had to put up with.
Hmm.
Well, I think I sold one house during that time frame. I wasn't with the real estate broker here very long. But at least that short time I was with him is when he was building a lot of places up here where we are now, as you know, up in the hill country. And so I bought 2 lots from him and just held on to them until we wanted to do something with them. And that's when we came back in 92 from Germany and we built. And love our home, even though it leaks.
Yeah. Well... You know what, that's, things happen for a reason, and, you know, maybe, you know, like I said, maybe this is Joan's,
forte to express.
Yeah, this is her big project right here. That's going to put her on the map. So, all right, so we finish up in Germany, we come back to Tucson, we're building a beautiful house up in the foothills, and so we talked about one grandchild decided to go continue on your in the family business.
Yes, he's the son of our oldest, Kevin. And Kevin has got his doctorate. He is a professor here at the University of Arizona.
What's he teach?
He's marine biology, and he's in that department. And he has 2 sons. Kevin is the older of the two, and Patrick, we've already talked about, who is the helicopter guy up in Alaska. Michael went on to get his master's, and he's been working for an air construction outfit, of all places, for Walton Beach. And how he got involved with him is when he was doing his master's, there was this company that does things for the military. Real estate, buildings, and things like that. And doing his master's, this is Michael again,
mm-hmm.
he got hired to kind of work into that business as a performance for his master's degree. The company ended up hiring him the minute he graduated. He's been with him ever since. And then his younger brother, Patrick, that we know is a helicopter guy. Tim, our middle son, is the fellow who went to Auburn, whereas the other two were U of A grads. He went to Auburn, and as a matter of fact, he got a scholarship in ROTC his freshman year, and and it was Air Force ROTC. No, it was Navy. Navy, I'm sorry. And after the first year with the Navy, he decided Navy wasn't for him, and so he quit the Navy ROTC and went over to Air Force ROTC and started, you know, hearing about what is Air Force ROTC all about. And finally, I get a letter from him just about the middle of the sophomore year. And it's a dear dad, don't know why you thought I would be the next fighter pilot in the family, blah, blah, blah. Bottom line, he was not, he's giving up the military. So you can imagine what, how that hit me.
Hmm.
And, well, it was tough. Finally, I called the commander of the unit, the Air Force ROTC guy, and he said, Fitz, don't do it. Don't do whatever you're thinking. He said, your son's been in here in tears several times, you know, talking with me about what should I do, what shouldn't I do, you know, what's my dad going to think? So he had to tell me something I should have known for my whole life. ROTC isn't for everybody. And college is a time for people to make their own decisions, not what their father or mother or anything else wants. And I thought, boy, did I need that conversation. So I thanked him profusely, wrote a letter to Tim, and said essentially, you know, what the guy told me to say. And so that was Tim.
And what's Tim doing now?
He is an FBI agent. Let me just backfire a little bit there. So he graduated from Auburn. He went with an airline company, I forget where, down in Florida, and was with them for about 4 years. Then he came back to U of A for his master's. Okay?
Okay.
So by this time, we're over in Germany, and I get a call from him, and he said, Dad, what do you know about the FBI? Said, FBI. Now here he's working on his master's here at U of A in engineering and in computers, I think it was. In any event, I said, FBI, what do you know about the, I don't know anything about the FBI except Herbert A. Philbrook and Peace and War, you know, that old
mm-hmm.
thing on TV. He said, no, I'm serious. I met a fellow at lunch one day who is back here getting his master's, and he's an FBI guy. I said, oh, okay. So that's how he got interested in FBI during his master's. And when he graduated, he went to the FBI. Now, we had missed his graduation from Auburn because we were overseas on that first tour. In any event, we missed it. And we missed his graduate business right here because we were in Europe. And finally, he's going down to Quantico. He's going to FBI school. And I said to Joan, you know, we haven't been to his either of his graduations. I think we ought to go back. Well, she didn't like flying for that, so I said, well, I'm going to head back. And I just happened to find out that Sink's airplane was coming back. I came back on the Sink's airplane about the time that Tim was going to graduate from Quantico, FBI school. and so, graduation, I stayed there until they gave out assignments. And they said, Honolulu, Hawaii, Tim Fitzsimmons. Well, the whole class started going, oh, Fitz, who the hell do you know? Blah, blah, blah. He said, I don't know anybody. So that's our FBI guy. He was at went over to Hawaii, and at that time FBI was kind of like the military. You know, we'll rotate every 3 years or whatever, just for whatever sake. So the guy who took over FBI said, "We don't need to do that. Let's leave people where they're doing a good job and so on." So he ended up there 7 years, and then came back to San Diego. That was the second tour. Now, those are two tough tours, aren't they?
Holy cow, Hawaii and then San Diego?
Yeah. And then he was offered other places, but no, and lo and behold, he gets the job right back here in Tucson.
You gotta be kidding me. He's living a charmed life.
Yeah. And then he comes to me one day and said, Dad, you know what, I think I'm going to retire. I said, your ass, retire? What do you mean? You're just a kid. I said, yeah. Mm-hmm. And what happened was somebody got in touch with him. He's sitting right down here in Tucson at his desk. And the guy who calls him and wants him to hire him was an FBI guy who retired. And when he retired, he started a business. The business he has and is, he takes all the contraband from FBI and he markets it. And then FBI evidently can get a cut as long as it's done by, you know, civilian hands. And so he hires ex-FBI guys, and he calls Tim one day and found out who he was and so on, and offers him a job. And Tim retired. He had 24 years in, I guess. And the only thing he had to hand in was his gun, his car, and his badge. To this day, he is in the same office here in Tucson, the same chair, working with the same guy, but he's a civilian. That's number two, son. If you want number three, he's out in California, and he's in the engineering business with communications for commercial airliners. And that winds up our clan all doing
that. That was Chris?
Chris.
That's right.
Yeah.
And how long has he been out in California?
He's been out there probably 7, 8 years, maybe even 10. His first job was up in Phoenix. Then he had another, and then this one.
Huh.
So he's been in the same, and he got his master's down in Texas, University of Texas. And all of them doing well.
Well, I can't believe he left Austin. It seems like once people go to Austin, they never come back.
Okay.
Well, all right. So, we covered a pretty magnificent career there, Colonel Fitzsimmons. You had some time since you left active duty. You've got a grandkid that's still involved in this kind of stuff.
Our FBI has a son and a daughter, and the son is at the University of Arizona as we speak in his sophomore year. And he is something else. He's quite a piano guy. He's been taking piano lessons for some time. And he graduated from Suarita to the university, but he's been taking piano lessons since he was about 8 or 9, I guess. And lo and behold, he was living on campus in the dorms his freshman year. But he didn't like the dorm business. It was too loud, too noisy, and so on. Meanwhile, he continues with his piano lessons until near the end or middle of his freshman year. He's still taking his piano lessons, and she's getting overloaded. And she says, why don't you teach some of these kids? You can do it. And so he takes her up on that, and he now is teaching piano lessons, earning pretty good money doing it, and he's finally got his driver's license. He mentioned to his dad how the dorms are so noisy. The FBI guy dad goes down to campus and buys a place down there just about a month ago. So he's moved into it. He still comes, and by the way, he's started the piano lessons now. He's been doing it for about a year, and he comes home from campus on Sunday, the weekend, Saturday and Sunday. He's got his own car now, and he gives piano lessons on Saturdays and Sundays right there at his home in Suarita. So there's a kid that's moving fast, and his sister is in her junior year, I think. She's got another year down in Suarita.
Junior in high school?
Yes.
And what's the, she got any aspirations for ROTC?
Not that I know of. No, I have not. As a matter of fact, I am. She knows I was in ROTC. And, no, they haven't, but she's quite a tennis player. She's number one for her school. So,
well, that
keeps her busy.
Yeah, that's pretty competitive down there in southern Arizona.
As a matter of fact, Tim, her father, the FBI guy, has volunteered into the assistant tennis coach down there at Suarita. So, that's all in the family right there.
Wow. Well, see, you've got a pretty... So you don't have... looking at all this family that you have in Tucson, there's no reason why your house should be leaking unnoticed in the summer, I'm thinking.
Well, I'll tell you what we do when we go back to New York, and it'll never happen again. I always leave the water on. I fix the toilets up and all that business, you know, so they're covered and solved. And as a matter of fact, this year before we went up to New York, we had all the faucets redone, except that one little one upstairs that is called the bar something, and it's a sink up there. And I think you know the rest of the story.
Mm-hmm.
Top thing on the bottom, and boom, we're all in this house business of cleaning up. But I didn't mean to get off the subject.
Oh, that I took you down that road. I tell you, we're close to the end here. I just what I like to ask at the end is, so if you could rewind, which of course we can't, but if you could rewind and you were starting as a freshman in ROTC at Rochester University, what knowing what you know now, would you do anything different?
Absolutely not. No. Because at every one of those, it was my decision. And if anybody had any influence on the decision-making as far as I went to U of University of Rochester by virtue of my older brother kind of leading the way, both academically and financially, and I guess I was making my own decisions ever since I lost my dad.
When you were
big
about 14.
Still kind of filled in for being the big brother.
Yeah.
And,
and
brother
which,
and sister.
Which you just lost him in January.
Yep. Yeah. He had been out of the business of law ever since he had that stroke. And I think I told you he and his wife made a decision. I ever mentioned that?
Yes, you did. You told me about that. So God bless her keeping all that up.
Yeah, for sure.
All right. Well, I think we're at the end, Colonel Fitzsimmons, so hold on. I'm going to go ahead and turn this off, and I appreciate your all of your candid responses for the last 2 days on this.
Hey, it was a labor of love, my friend.